Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Jeff Booth. He's an entrepreneur, technology leader, and the author of The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. How are you today, Jeff?
Great. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So I wanted to start by getting your perspective on why you wrote this book for your kids and what puzzle pieces you wanted to put together for them to understand.
I'm sitting at the front edge of technology and how fast that's moving. So in a whole bunch of companies, I'm either co-founder of or chairman of, and also the research from the universities and globally around where artificial intelligence is going. And from that vantage point, technology is moving way faster than people realize, way faster. And when you realize technology is moving that fast, technology is also... it creates so much efficiency, and then that efficiency creates deflation. So you have a deflationary force greater than the world has ever seen, wanting to drive prices down. And you have governments trying to stop that because we've always lived in an inflationary world. And so they're printing money to try to stop that deflationary force. Those two forces are colliding on society and causing everything else. And I looked at what would happen to my kids in that future. And I thought, it's those two forces are incompatible together. And so it means giant changes to the way we think and the way we rewire economies that governments have no clue on right now. And so I wrote the book to be able to lay out that thesis, what was happening, how most of what you see in the world is a second order consequence of that fight and what it would likely look like on the other side of it.
Perfect. So when you speak about technology being deflationary, can you explain to us a little bit more about how that works, Jeff?
Yeah. So if you look at your phone today, think about your phone 20 years ago, think about your phone today. 20 years ago, it was just a phone. Today, it's everything. It's an AI assistant. It's your maps. It's your camera. It's your music player. It's a million other things that are all free, right? And so we actually celebrate deflation in all of the, essentially the monopolies that we've created are celebrating deflation, right? So in Apple, it's celebrating that path of we get more and more for less. And that free creates abundance. Now, keep in mind, so my first phone cost $2,000. My first phone bill cost $1,200. And that was now 25 years ago, right? I could get a phone cheaper today. Right, a new phone cheaper today. And if I wanted to wait till next year, I could get a free phone, right? And it has way more abundance. So that's what I'm talking about, that technology abundance. But we think it's just in our phones or our TVs getting bigger for less or electronics. It's everywhere. It's in absolutely everything. It's masked by massive monetary easing. It's masked by a debt that can't be paid back, and it's masked by central banks easing. I'll give you an example. Right. So people say, well, housing always goes up, right? But they fail to ask the question, before COVID, $250 trillion of global debt supporting an $80 trillion global economy. $185 trillion of that global debt has come in the last 20 years to stop what I'm talking about. Debt has to rise that much faster to stop exponential trend in technology. And so then when they connect the dots, my housing always goes up, they fail to ask, would my housing go up without $185 trillion of stimulus? Or will it always go up in the future unless there's that much more stimulus?
Mm-hmm. So explain to us a little bit more about why governments are trying to basically stop deflation, why they see it as a bad thing, and explain to us why it's basically a hidden tax.
Let's start just with deflation in your own life, right? You want things to get cheaper. And you want things to be more abundant, right? You're always on the search for that, right? So deflation itself is, instead of getting caught up in the emotion of deflation or inflation, deflation is when your money is worth more, right? You can buy more goods and services with your money. Inflation is the opposite. Your money is worth less. Goods and services go up in relation to your money. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, those two things have different consequences for how the world works, right? So in what we all want is actually our money to be worth more. But if deflation happens against massive debt, the debt gets more and more expensive. It can't be paid back, right? And so to try to stop what's happening, all the government seizing and everything else, they're actually making the problem that much worse, right? Because if you try to create inflation against a deflationary force, what you're doing is you're pushing it. If you assume the debt has to be paid back, then taxes must go up in the future to pay back the debt. Mm-hmm. And if taxes go up, the economy crashes, right? So we're way past the point of rescue on the old system. So now why do governments need to try to create that inflation at all costs? It's because the entire system unwinds if you let deflation happen. And when I say entire system unwinds, I mean banking failures, global finance stops, everything else, stock market falls by 90%. That's a consequence of letting deflation happen today. But that consequence is only because governments have tried to stop it for so long and mm-hmm. made the problem bigger and bigger. And that consequence is coming no matter what, right? So can governments continue to drive inflation against the force we're talking about? They can drive asset price inflation right now by essentially central banks taking assets off the balance sheet of banks and putting new fresh money, but it's not making M2 consumer spending go up. So you can expect the next step of this where Treasury becomes the Fed, right? So essentially intervention by governments. And then you can expect MMT, you can expect a whole bunch of things in a fight to get inflation, right? And at some point they'll be successful, but it'll take an order of magnitude more money in the economy to make them more successful. But I'll ask you this, and this is really important. Banks won't lend and the economy won't really grow unless there's actually business opportunities to be able to create an economy. Mm-hmm. So once you centralize all power in governments, essentially by destroying the free market, essentially deciding who wins, who loses, there is no free market anymore. Free market's almost dead today, but that transfer of power makes it almost complete. And so I know a bunch of your listeners like gold and other stuff too, and they like it for that same reason, because you can see this pattern playing out around the world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I'd like to touch on there. So is the condition of monetary velocity, as you're speaking about, you know, consumer spending, M2. So is the condition of monetary velocity continuing to fall the consequence of this deflationary force?
Yes. There's not enough. Banks won't lend against. So if central bank says, here's a whole bunch of fresh new printed money, a bank is still a private enterprise and they have their own credit departments and everything else. And why would they lend to a business that they know can't pay the back that those dollars? Mm-hmm. So you could expect, unless there's a robust economy, banks won't lend. And that transmission mechanism today, that why you see central banks wanting to do their own digital currencies, why you see MMT becoming really popular, helicopter drops, is because if banks won't lend, we're going to go around the bank and we're going to get it directly to citizens. That's what's that effect. And when I said the free market dies, now central banks are in competition with banks. Up until that point, and it hasn't happened yet, but up until that point, banks have been the number one beneficiary of central banks' policies. Now, the next step, the next shoe to drop, they become competitors.
So as you were talking earlier about interest rates, what would happen if the Fed actually tried to reduce its balance sheet or tried to raise its interest rates to kind of step back in?
So because there's so much leverage in a system, right? The current economy, the structural deficits are so staggering, right? If people don't, about $4 trillion in the US this year, Canada's bigger as a percentage of GDP, staggering structural deficits. That debt can't be repaid. So now say I'm going to increase my rates, right? Number one, the Fed has transferred a bunch of the risk out of the private sector to their balance sheet. So how could they do that, right? Because they're effectively their debt, it goes offside. Their maturities are different and it collapses a system. Worse than that, the entire economy goes down faster and it makes a reset happen. So they're stuck in a trap. They're stuck in a debt trap that they can't get out of, and there's nothing that can get them out of it.
And that's why you say there's basically only two choices, this deflationary depression or for them to be able to inflate away the debt. And obviously they're choosing the latter, correct?
Exactly. But that inflation away of the debt, it effectively, if you just kind of pull the strings on what happens next and next, there is no free market. It's central control of all markets. That's the only way that you could actually inflate away the debt. And even then, it would be such a staggering amount of debt, because technology is moving exponential one way. So it's way bigger force looking forward than people realize. So a lot of people get trapped in that because they're looking backwards. They're looking backwards at the $185 trillion for the last 20 years and saying, how do we pay that back? Instead of looking forward and saying, in the next 4 years, they're going to have to create about the same to keep it stable, right? Mm-hmm. And so looking forward, it's impossible. So I would say at some points, governments can create enough money, right? They can print enough money to be able to create inflation because they control a printing press. It's just what point along that axis do people go, what's money in the first place, right? And when those things break, when you lose faith in money, then you get hyperinflation.
So Jeff, there's something I wanted to pull on one of the threads that you mentioned there. When you're saying we basically don't have a free market anymore. And in doing some research for today's interview, you've been saying that there's basically a free market for the rich, but not the poor. So can you explain to us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, a bunch of people, my friends as well, right? So what happens if you drive central bank policies today, right? So essentially, prices should be falling. But if prices fell, then the entire thing unwinds and you have a deflationary depression. Mm-hmm. So that's the free market requires that, right? That's creative destruction, and where you make a bad bet, you lose, right? That's what the free market requires. By stopping that force, essentially central banks, let's use an example because it's easier to see. What should real estate prices be in major cities today? Not the same or higher than they've ever been, right? Because there's way less people using that commercial real estate. We're all on Zoom, we're on everything else. So unless you believe that was coming back tomorrow, full occupancy, you must also agree that real estate prices have to fall to what occupancy is today. But if those real estate prices fell, banks would be impaired. The entire system would be impaired. So central banks are propping those up by taking bad assets off balance sheets of banks and replacing fresh money. Now that price doesn't have to fall. Same thing for residential real estate, why residential real estate's going ever higher right now, everything else. So on one side, if you have the assets, real estate, stocks, everything else, those assets are going straight up in value because of that easing. Right? So a whole bunch of people with the assets, and who has the assets? It's all the rich, right? We have more assets. So those assets are stimulated as a byproduct of that. The same example I gave, the $185 trillion into real estate, what would those prices look like without, right? So all my real estate has gone up, all my stocks have gone up by those same policies. Now, if you don't have the assets, those policies are holding prices high. And then a whole bunch of people on the other side of those, education, food, housing, everything else, can't pay for those artificially high prices that were stimulated in the first place by the central banks. And they're losing out. So effectively, we're picking the pockets of the people who can't afford the assets and giving more money to the asset owners. And then those people rise up and they vote for politicians that say, I'm going to fix it for you and I'm going to give you more money without asking where the money is coming from in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right. So then those politicians get into power by promising free money for people who were hurt by that same thing. And it's all caused by a system that can't see, everybody's stuck in the same system. One-on-one. So you're pushing asset prices higher artificially to give more people money to pay for those artificially high prices, right? Seems kind of crazy. And that's what is meant where the free market just completely dies.
Mm-hmm. So as we're seeing basically a global debasement of all these currencies and every central bank printing to be able to give all of their citizens some kind of, you know, something to tide them over. Obviously, we're speaking the day after the election, and we've seen, or what do you think the consequences of this delayed stimulus could be? We've already seen that it's being contested. So could we see the unwind start to begin because of this? And if so, would it be really hard to stop?
Yeah. So I put a tweet out the other day that said that. Now, the Fed still has policy room that they could take more assets off balance sheets and everything else and stop the real unwind kind of at the top of the pyramid where banks and everything else. So they could stop it there, but they can't stop that unwind from happening at small businesses, restaurants, everything else. So if you think of how much of the stimulus that was already spent, it didn't drive the economy one bit. It plugged a hole for people to pay their rents and people to pay their mortgages and people to pay their food and everything else. And that stimulus is gone. And so what looks like a bright spot in the economy, jobs came back because people actually had more money. They weren't driving their cars as much, everything else. They had more money and they had the stimulus dollars to buy things, is now spent. If stimulus doesn't come, if the stimulus doesn't come till February, you might have such a destruction of value at that business level. What do you stimulate when it comes? Right. Mm-hmm. So if you actually have a deflationary spiral start to take place, it spreads really quickly. Most people can't see the unintended consequences. And by the way, you said this perfectly. It's global. Remember in 2008, one of my business in 2008, banks in China and around the world wouldn't take our LCs, our letters of credit. Mm-hmm. For a very short window, trade stopped, right? And we could see that in our business before central banks, all the policies came in to say we're flooding the system with equity because that transmission mechanism globally was stopping. Mm-hmm. But people didn't see it because they were looking narrowly, right? Same thing could happen here, right? Same thing could happen here. If you start to unwind and the stimulus doesn't come fast enough, you could have that unwinding the entire system.
So when every country is doing this, is it possible that basically everybody is devaluing at somewhat of a same rate and actually push off the risk of one specific currency crashing versus the others?
No. So the reason for that is if you were able to do that, it doesn't fix the balance of trade, right? And the balance of trade is connected to jobs and everything else. So if you go back to the technology, when in our lives, reduces labor. No CEO puts in technology to increase their prices. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that. I can tell you the companies that I do, what they do for less. And the byproduct, why we use it as human beings, is it gives us more for less too, right? You cannot stop that no matter what. It's moving so fast. All the opposite is doing, fighting that force, is a competition for less and less jobs globally, right? And every country with their own currency is trying to drive their currency value down through inflation, right? To be able to get more share of the jobs. And so as every country is trying to do this, then you see some of the consequences. So people ask in Canada, why are housing prices so high? Without asking, okay, why are Asians buying the housing prices? And they're buying them because they're trying to get their money out of China. Mm-hmm. Into something that can't be devalued as fast as the yuan can be and what's coming next. And so this is a global phenomenon that's creating bubbles everywhere.
As you're mentioning Canada and the flight to what some other countries could consider safety, we've seen Canada's balance sheet as you said, a percentage of our GDP grow much, much faster than anybody else's. So what are the consequences of that?
If you look over the longer term, every currency is going to fail. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you looked at what's happening in Turkey today or Lebanon or Venezuela, it's just kind of going across the world. And people say, okay, well, look at what's happening. The hyperinflation is coming to Turkey and they're essentially their currency failing. But they're not asking the question in Canada saying, we just lost a trading partner because they can't buy our goods, mm-hmm. right, for the same price. Not only that, their labor just got way cheaper, right? And then that carries forward country after country after country. So those feedback effects are pretty dramatic and they're not being considered in how fast this happens. So what you're talking about in Canada, we're not after Turkey, right? We still have a stable government. We still have a bunch of things going for natural resources that should do well in a printing world. But at some sort of continuum, if you're just printing money to pretend you have an economy, currencies collapse.
Mm-hmm. So could we see basically the opposite happen, considering the US is the global reserve currency? If we see that crash, wouldn't we expect a flight to safety in dollars and the value of the US dollar go up for a certain amount of time?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's exactly what would happen.
Perfect. So how do we protect our wealth, Jeff? Like, there's so many, as you say, deflationary forces and inflationary forces from the central banks. What, in your view, is some of the best ways to protect the purchasing power of the currencies that we have right now?
Gold traditionally has done well. Commodities have traditionally done well. Commodities in general right now, they're really low in relation to what's happening. So commodities should do well as a store of value, specifically some commodities. I think personally, Bitcoin is the best by far, and not just as a store of value, but as a lifeboat into what's coming.
And one of the positives you see of Bitcoin is the portability of it if and when it comes down to people actually trying to get out of a certain place, right?
That's the big thing. You can remember 12 words. You can go anywhere in the world. In anything else, gold, everything else, you're relying on somebody else's custody, right? Mm-hmm. And we've seen how that's worked throughout the world, right? When that custody, grab it, change value. That can't happen on Bitcoin. So governments can try to close down nodes and networks, but because it's so distributed, the other nodes will pick that up. And it creates game theory, where if US governments tried to shut down Bitcoin, it creates an incentive for other governments to accept it. And so what a lot of people miss in how fast technology is going is they look at an initial use case and they project that initial use case forward. Right. So why Microsoft missed Google is because when Google was coming out in search, you couldn't monetize search. And Google did one thing well, really narrow use case that had no money in it. And so all the giants missed them. Bitcoin is very similar to that. People are looking at its store of value against central banks or gold previously and everything else. And it has a whole bunch of properties that make it a better store of value, in my opinion, than gold. Other people will believe differently, but in my opinion, because it's built on technology and because the infrastructure behind it gets better and better over time, they're missing what will happen to it. And so I think it looks like that network effect that's driving Bitcoin and why it's moving up in price. Every new person on it makes it more valuable for everybody else, not just in value, in the technology layer that's going to come next.
So is there, in your opinion, Jeff, what role does gold still play in this new, let's say, economy with having a digital form of currency like that?
This might be hard for gold bugs to hear, but investigate what I'm saying just on its principles. Mm-hmm. So you can disagree with kind of the premise, but let's not get emotional about the thing. Because most people in Bitcoin or gold actually believe in the same thing. They believe in there needs to be sound money. And if you give governments control of everything, you'll eventually destroy currencies and hurt populations. So they believe in the same thing. Now, some people might believe gold is a better store of value. And historically, it has been. Like for 5,000 years, it has been. Because there wasn't something else. Mm-hmm. Right. And it was the best store of value. And it has its own problems, right? It has a bunch of its own problems. But if you look at the market cap of gold, let's call it what, $12 trillion, right? Around $12 trillion. Mm-hmm. And you say, is that $12 trillion supported by fundamentals or is it supported because it's a store of value? Right. It's not because of jewelry. It's because people believe, trust that it'll be pegged to money again at some point. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, anytime you're betting against something and betting for something, there's bound to be a whole bunch of people who don't believe you, because otherwise it wouldn't be $12 trillion, right? Market cap. So there's a whole bunch of people that believe that because it's always been so going back 5,000 years, right? Gold's mm-hmm. been the store of value. And now you have Bitcoin that's a challenger to that system for the same reasons. A better portability, built on a network effect, built on a bunch of things. And it has a market cap of, say, $250 billion. And so if I looked at the asymmetric bet, you almost have to be in Bitcoin, right? Because those are competing for the same market, mm-hmm. right? And if Bitcoin wins, gold can't stay at $12 trillion. And so one has to fall. In the short term, I will be wrong. In the short mm-hmm. term, gold could go up, Bitcoin could go up. But if you looked over the long term, or the better place to, or less risk, or more asymmetric bet, I think Bitcoin is a must-own asset.
So what do you mean when you say by timeline, Jeff? Like, is it possible that we see them both go up simply because there are going to be people that traditionally believe in gold and also the new system of Bitcoin?
Short term, yes. But this will be helpful for a whole bunch of your audience. In 1995, there were 16 million people on the internet. Mm-hmm. 16 million people. Today, there's 5 billion. Mm-hmm. Right? The internet in 1995, it took half an hour to download a cat picture. Right? The use cases were terrible. Right? It was terrible to be able to see. And so a lot of people discounted what was going to happen on that technology, and how so many companies that sit on top of that network effect are created and what ends up happening out of that technology. Most people missed what was going to happen, mm-hmm. right? So Paul Krugman in 1998 said the internet will provide no more value than the fax machine,
right?
Central bankers, right? What they're projecting the use case of what it looks like then forward. Mm-hmm. And because they're looking backwards against what it was, they were right for a time. That's what's happening on Bitcoin today. If you looked at the numbers, internet growth versus Bitcoin growth, they're the same. So that network effect is growing at that rate. And that rate of making them more and more valuable as more and more people come in, because it becomes more of a trusted medium of exchange. Mm-hmm. Even this conversation 3 years ago, we wouldn't have been having, right? And now more people are questioning, okay, could that look like now it's more stable, now it's going up and more people are coming on, making it more and more valuable. And so I think that's what it looks like going forward. That's why it's a must-own asset.
Interesting. So Jeff, as we see all of these different forces playing out right now, what does the great unwind look like to you, and what steps are there along that way?
So this isn't bad people, by the way. Mm-hmm. People think they're these people that are trying to create all this pain. There's billions of conspiracy theories today. It's just what a system does to protect itself. Mm-hmm. And the system that we've grown up in all our lives is an inflationary monetary system. And central banks had the power to be able to lower interest rates or take off risk to be able to keep it going, right? Trying to drive that inflation. And that inflation, mm-hmm. we didn't notice, because it was really small inflation. We didn't notice that the purchasing power of our money was not really great. It was going down over time, right? So that's what inflation is, right? So if you driving inflation is wage deflation. So your labor is getting cheaper, mm-hmm. right? People miss that. So a lot of people say, wait, I can't afford these things. It's because your wages are going down, right? But at a small fraction, we didn't see what was happening to us. And now it's happening in a greater magnitude. Now, in other parts of the world, they saw these inflationary currencies, regime change, everything else. So in the West, we've been a small window of time, if you look back at history, a small window of time in this experiment that we've been pretty fortunate. But we also miss what's happened. We miss what's happening in other countries where they have the extreme swings, right? That's coming here, right? I can't tell you when.
Yep.
But it's coming here. And that reset is going to be painful. The next 10 years is going to be painful, because you have to unwind that credit system one of two ways. Drive hyperinflation to make the debt go away, right? With the real debt is changed through hyperinflation or deflationary depression. Mm-hmm. One of those two ways. And by the way, if you drive hyperinflation, how do you stop it? Right. Remember in 80 and 81, and when Volcker took interest rates to 20-odd% to effectively stop inflation, right, and get it control. How does the central bank, and that's when central bank was independent, right? Now central banks won't be independent. It'll be treasury. So it'll be government controlling that. Can you imagine a government entity saying, now that we have hyperinflation, I'm going to increase rates forever and collapse the economy on purpose to stop this on my watch? I doubt it. Mm-hmm. So once this takes hold, how do you stop it? So those are the only two choices, unfortunately, right now. You have a hyperinflationary environment or a deflationary depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like once that fuse is lit, it's going to be very hard to back away from that eventual outcome.
Yeah, and if you just play that hyperinflationary outcome, remember, the central banks and the banks and the governments have taken on the risk from the free market. So increasing the rates doesn't collapse the businesses like it did in 81. It collapses the central banks and the currencies themselves. So I've said this often, by stopping creative destruction in the free market, all you did is moved creative destruction to the governments and currencies. It just moved up.
Mm-hmm. And to kind of tie that back to what we were speaking about earlier, does that happen everywhere, like globally all at once, because everybody is inflating away their currency or debasing their currency like that? Or can it be concentrated in certain areas?
It'll be wild swings back and forth that will fool people, right? So for a time, if you looked at MMT, for an example, which will come into the US, helicopter money, the stimulus package that they're doing, and then the next stimulus and the next stimulus, trust me, they are coming, mm-hmm. right? Whether they come too late, whether they come, but once they start coming, they're going to come and they're going to keep coming, right? So that for a time might actually work and people will feel, wow, this worked, mm-hmm. right? It won't solve it. And by doing it, it'll create imbalances in other countries and everything else. So you could see violent swings back and forth. And if you looked at a time horizon, people going, yeah, told you so, told you MMT would work, right? It's a very short time horizon and it doesn't prevent the failure.
Well, that's some terrible, terrible news there, Jeff. But you're saying that you're an optimist, right?
So why do we use technology? Why do, if you saw what was actually happening, we mm-hmm. use it to free our time, right? That's what we do. So on one side, in this other world, we are accepting lower and lower wages, right? In real wages. We're mm-hmm. saying we want inflation to drive down wages so we can work more, so we can pay for artificially high prices. Mm-hmm. That's the game the world's playing. The entire globe is playing that game and all artificial. And on the other side of this, what we actually want in our lives is to work all our lives so we can retire in the last 5 years and have enough money to be able to travel, right? Or that's what the other world looks like. Technology frees your time. Mm-hmm. The natural course is prices should go down. If innovation, if human ingenuity, innovation, and technology has to create more abundance for us and declining prices, it has to, then the natural order of things is our time is enhanced, right? So why I wrote in the book, why deflation is key to an abundant future, is we just don't see this in our lives. We don't see the truths that are right in front of us. It's impossible to charge for oxygen that you breathe because it's abundant. It's free. Mm-hmm. And technology is creating that everywhere. It's a manipulation of monetary policy that why we don't see those prices and abundance coming everywhere. And that abundance would be, so everything else is a tax on our time. Mm-hmm. Where what would actually happen just out of the natural, it would be ugly on the way through, but it's going to be ugly on the way through anyways. You can't stop gravity from happening, mm-hmm. right? What would happen is technology would, as prices decline, they would decline more and more. And the free market entrepreneurs like me would race in to where you could still make money.
And keep making things more efficient.
And that would mean broad-based abundance to society if you let that happen. And so that's where it's going to go eventually anyways. It's probably going to take a forcing function like Bitcoin to be able to drive it to that, or a new standard of currency to be able to drive it to that.
Crazy times, Jeff. Do you have anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up here?
No, that's great. Thanks again for having me.
Thanks for your time, Jeff. As always, you're available on Twitter at Jeff Booth and also at Price of Tomorrow on Twitter. Anywhere else you'd like to tell anybody where to find you?
That's perfect. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks for your time today, Jeff.
Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?